This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director, Kat Johnson, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in Three.
I think we should realize that we more or less have a broken food system. When 800 million of us go to bed hungry, 600 million are obese, we waste 30% of our food, then something is fundamentally wrong.
We'll introduce you to one food waste solution happening in Asia.
They introduced a system where residents were issued an electronic ID card that would open an automated bin and enable them to weigh the food waste being dropped off, and then they would be charged, you know, in a certain amount of money for the weight of that food.
And we'll take a look at some of the real struggles happening closer to home.
How is it possible that a meal that was perfectly fine to consume at 10:59 p.m. then becomes waste at 11 p.m.
So tune in to this week's Meat in Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Line here on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Eli Sussman, co-owner of Samisa Restaurant and Ed and Bev Restaurants in Brooklyn. My guest today is Chef Matt Abdu. He's the chef partner of the Brooklyn barbecue restaurant Pig Beach and Manhattan's Pig Bleecker, which is a full-service smoke food influence restaurant located in Greenwich Village. Pig Beach was named one of Eater's essential barbecue restaurants, and Pig Bleecker received a strong one-star review from the New York Times. Matt was previously the CDC of Del Posto, and he was with the restaurant when it received its four-star review from the New York Times. He's appeared on TV many times, including The Today Show and The Chew, and he first earned his barbecue chops during his stints with the Salty Rinse Squad, which we'll talk about in a little bit, where he received second place medal for Whole Hog in 2015, and first place for best sauce at the annual Memphis in May World Championships. Today we're going to talk smoke, lots and lots of meat, what it's like to go from opening up restaurants and being a chef of two restaurants in two different boroughs, and of course, his favorite type of barbecue. Matt, welcome to the show.
How you doing, my pal? Thanks for having me.
So, as always with this show, we like to start kind of in childhood at the beginning, talking about how people got interested in food, what those influences were. So, you grew up in New Hartford, New York.
I did.
Italian and Lebanese heritage.
Yes,
so
sir.
I would love for you to talk a little bit about what was your childhood like growing up there, and which one, if either of those influences, played a role in your childhood and your love of food.
How long we have on the show today?
You have exactly 47 more minutes to
talk.
All
right, fantastic. Well, here we go. So I am born and raised in upstate New York, the small town of New Hartford. It's, if anybody's familiar with central New York, it's near Utica / Rome area. It's about 45 minutes east of Syracuse, New York, and about an hour and a half west of Albany. As you said, I'm half Italian, half Lebanese. In my entire life, I grew up with my Italian grandmother and side of the family telling me to mangia, and the Lebanese side of my family telling me to sartain, which basically both mean eat, love, be happy. And food was always the center of our family. It was what brought our family together. We sat down and ate dinner every single night. I'm one of four boys, each of my size, which is pretty incredible considering, you know, God bless my mother for being able to keep our fridge full, especially when we would have all of our friends over, because our place was the cool place to come and hang out after school and eat, because mom always had the best food. But food really sort of shaped my entire existence. I mean, I grew up always loving the power of food. And when I was applying for culinary schools, I wrote in my essay, I love the power of food, whether it be a piece of chocolate when you're sad or a bowl of chicken soup when you're sick. Food has that unique ability to make you feel better or put a smile on somebody's face. And that was always, for me, such a big part of my life. And food was the epicenter of my grandmother's and my mother basically just showing their love through an actual physical means of food and bringing us together.
Was Sunday a exclusively Italian affair, or did Lebanese dishes kind of creep into the family gatherings?
I'm seeing
like this table that has like, I don't know, malawach, but also spaghetti and meatballs. I don't know. Is that a thing that happens?
You know what's really funny is that very often that would be the case. So growing up, Friday nights was always my grandmother's, my Lebanese grandmother's. She lived nearby. My Italian grandparents lived in Bethel, Connecticut. So that was like a 4-hour drive for us to go there. But when we were younger and they were younger, they would come to, you know, our house. And, you know, my favorite food memories would be my Italian grandmother coming to our house and the aroma of the Sunday gravy and meatballs and sausage and brajol or tomato sauce, whatever you guys want to call it. She'd bring her big pot. She'd go, you know, to Costco and she'd buy all her right Italian imported tomatoes that she wanted to use. And she'd start like browning off the brajol at like 6 o'clock in the morning and like waking up as a kid. That was like the best smell on the planet. I'm like salivating right now. Like yeah, thinking about it. I can't even like speak properly.
That is a good thing. It's not a traditional breakfast smell. It's not quite the American bacon or eggs
or waffles. Not at all, but it was better.
Something like, delicious to wake up to. Yeah.
Me and my brothers, we'd wake up and we'd start trying to sneak meatballs out of the big old pot of sauce. And she would like slap her hand. She'd be like, they're not done yet. She's like, I've got those counted. I know exactly how many are supposed to be in there. But you know, at Fridays, we would go to my Lebanese grandmother's house and we would have a lot of like mjadra, the rice and lentils, or like kibineya. Like I grew up eating raw meat and had no idea it was raw meat until I was probably like 12 and I just ate it and loved it. You know, and onions, olive oil,
pita
bread.
You told someone, you're like, yeah, we eat raw meat all the time. And they were like, what do you mean you eat raw meat?
Oh yeah. I was a kid in junior high that was bringing either like, you know, a chicken cutlet sandwich to school or like a bowl of rice and lentils. Yeah, and not having any idea that like wasn't the normal thing. Like my friends had fruit roll-ups and peanut butter and jellies and potato chips. And I would try desperately to trade with them. I'm like, I want a fruit roll-up. My mom won't give me those things. But for example, at Thanksgiving, we would always have Thanksgiving at my Lebanese grandmother's house. And on her table would always be like a mix of Lebanese food. Obviously, there'd be the turkey, but she'd get like the smallest turkey possible because nobody really cared. And she would do a bunch of Lebanese food, rice and lentils, kibbeh, grape leaves, like all that fun, delicious stuff. But there'd also be like a pan of baked ziti in the corner as well because, you know, she wanted to feed all of her grandchildren. Sometimes we were a little more picky than we'd like to be. I, however, wasn't. You people at home listening can't see me, but I have this physical, muscular, gigantic build. No, I'm not that way at all, but I love to eat. And clearly it shows.
So when you're growing up and you're surrounded by this big extended family where clearly food is playing a big role, you started off pretty young getting involved in food. You were working at a place called Cafe Canole.
Yes.
And so let's talk a little bit about that. How did you get that job? Were you strong-armed into that job? Or
no,
were you
I really want to
get involved in food?
That's a super great story. So growing up, I went through this phase in junior high where I got super into baking, like cheesecakes, chocolate torts, cookies, like you name it. It was my MO. My mom got me a Hershey's cookbook
awesome.
For Christmas one year. And it was my goal to cook my way through this entire cookbook. So I started doing, you know, just for fun on my days off because I don't know even how I had the time. I did sports and everything as well. But I would make these cheesecakes and these chocolate torts. And one day my mother had a faculty party. So my father and my mother both worked at the same junior high together. My father taught 7th grade math for 33 years in the same classroom at the same school. And my mother worked in the guidance department. Not as long as my dad worked there because she was raising us. And once we were old enough, she went back to work. Side note, my parents are my heroes. If I can become half the man my father is by the time I die, I know I will have lived a very successful life. But I made a cake one day for my mother to take to a faculty party. And one of the teachers at the faculty party said, oh my God, where did you get this cake from? It's incredible. And my mom's like, Matthew made it. And he's like, what do you mean? She's like, I can't get him out of the kitchen. You know, he loves to cook, doesn't like to clean all that much, but loves to cook. And this gentleman's name was Ralph Polito. And he said, well, does he ever want to do it professionally? Is he looking for a summer job? And she's like, I don't know. Let me ask him. So she came home that day, and Cafe Canole, for those of you that know upstate New York and know the Utica area, Jason and Dean Knoll are two of like the most culinarily talented people back home in central New York. And they have an incredible bakery cafe that makes Italian wedding cakes, pastries, cookies, like the whole gambit, you name it, with a delicious food, lunches, and dinners. And the Revered is one of the best restaurants back home. So when my mom came home and asked me if I wanted to work at Cafe Canole, I was like, oh, yes, absolutely. Sign me up. That'd be a dream come true. So she's like, okay. Ralph said, be at the bakery at 6 a.m. I was like, oof, okay, 6 a.m., let's do this. I'm ready. So I got there at like 5:30 because I was so anxious and so excited. You know, it was still dark outside when I went. And you know, I went into the kitchen and the first thing they did was like have me wash dishes, which is totally normal because I'm, you know, 15, 16 years old. I've never really worked in a professional restaurant before and have no idea, like no idea what I'm doing. And, you know, one of my favorite memories of being back there is I was in the dish station and they were whipping up gigantic floor Hobart mixers worth of a Chambord, like raspberry flavored whipped cream frosting for some of the cakes they were making, and then a chocolate Godiva frosting for some of the cakes that they were making. And they would bring the whip attachments back to the dish pit for me to put in the dish machine and eat. And I was like,
I know where this is going.
They bring it back to me and I'm looking at it. I'm looking around. I'm like, putting my finger on the whisk, putting a little in my mouth, tasting it, being like, oh my God, this is the greatest job ever. I get to snack on all these delicious things. So about an hour into the day, the older brother Dean came up to me and said, Maddie, I got a job for you. You don't want to wash dishes. Our dishwasher's here. Like, you're here to like learn. So come here. He gave me a 5-gallon bucket of cannoli cream and put me in a pastry bag with just a round tip on it and put me in the corner and said, I want you to fill all these cannoli shells until the cream is gone. And I was like, oh my God, this is heaven. I was like, yeah, I'm on it. So he shows me how to use the pastry bag. I have this 5-gallon bucket of cannoli cream, a spatula, and like boxes and boxes of cannoli shells. And I'm just filling the cannolis like one at a time. He's like, make sure you get it all the way to the center because it's, you know, it's the worst thing ever when a cannoli has like an air gap in the middle. You got to show me the right way to do it. And I'm like, piping a cannoli, putting some on my finger, eating it, piping a cannoli, putting some on my finger, eating it. And these guys, you know, as they saw that I had an aptitude for it and really loved it, they continued to give me more and more opportunities to do more things in the kitchen and advance me through the ranks. So I ended up working at Cafe Canola for, I think, like 7 years throughout high school and college, like all my summer times in college. And Dean and Jason were both graduates of the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. So they sort of cultivated me and progressed me into that transition to go to that school. So I attended State University of New York at Geneseo to get my undergrad in business. Because when I told my father I wanted to go to culinary school, he's like, you know, maybe this is just a phase. It's probably a good idea for you to have a bachelor's in something just in case, you know, you decide you don't want to cook for the rest of your life. And then if you still want to do this afterwards, we'll get you signed up for culinary school.
But you still got something that was applicable to the restaurant world and the food world.
I
you
did.
Were still pretty lasered in at that point.
I did and I was. I graduated with a bachelor's in business administration, but I wanted to go to Cornell. And my dad was like, Matt, you know, you're one of three boys. Cornell is an exceptionally amazing school. However, we can't afford it. You're more than welcome to apply. I'll pay for your application fee, which was like $200 or something crazy. I was like, all right, I got waitlisted. But you know, it turns out Geneseo was a great choice. I met a lot of great people and got a great head start on going to culinary school.
And so you do end up in Hyde Park and you do end up going to the CIA, right?
Yep, I went to the CIA.
And so you graduated from there, and so I'll ask you now, looking back, now that you are running restaurants, you have many people on your staff, what are your thoughts now on culinary school versus when you attended? Because you actually did something, you got a lot of on-the-job training, right? You worked at Cafe Canole for 7 years.
Yeah.
You probably came into culinary school with a lot more experience than most of the people there, but and then you also had a college degree.
Yep.
So you were kind of in a different boat than a lot of the folks there. Do you still think that you would recommend to a lot of people to go to culinary school or not?
You know what, I feel like it's kind of a loaded question, but anyway, so yes, when I went to culinary school, I was way, way, way ahead of my class. I went into so the way the Culinary Institute of America works, it's a rolling admission. So they accept a class like every 2 weeks or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I enrolled, you know, I graduated from college, I took the summer off and I went right back into that sort of September start time as if I was just going back to school. And because of it, the majority of the kids in my class were like 17 and 18 year olds that had just graduated high school. And I was 22 because I just graduated college. And I also had all this culinary training behind me, like, you know, all through high school, all through college, I was working. And yes, I was certainly a leg up on most people there. You know, culinary school is an incredible opportunity to get classical formal training in an, you know, institutional level environment. The downside to it in this day and age is that it's really, really expensive. I mean, the Culinary Institute of America, I think, is somewhere around like, I don't know, $45,000 a year now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't that much when I went.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a lot of money. I mean, it's a big commitment.
Yeah, it's a financial commitment.
Yeah, to be in debt $200,000 at the end of like, because now that they're a 4-year program, which is great because you can get a bachelor's as well.
Right.
But to be in debt that much money, and then graduate. And then, I mean, back in my day, I left culinary school to go get a job. I started working in Boston. We still got a long tour to go on my culinary path. But anyways, you know, you graduate and you're making minimum wage for the first 2-3 years of your career as a cook, because, you know, as much as you might think you know a lot upon graduating culinary school, the reality is that there's nothing like actual physical hands-on training, being in a kitchen, being in that pressure cooker environment, working with different personalities and people of different talent levels and chefs of, you know, extreme accolades that have done a lot of things, won a lot of awards, and have been in the industry for a very long time. So do I think education is good? Absolutely. I think it's one of the greatest things that exists in our country. As far as culinary school, it's, you know, one could argue that if you have an in and you know somebody and they're willing to take you under the wing the way the Noel brothers took me under the wing and teach you and show you, and then, you know, a lot of what I tell a lot of new hires for any of the restaurants, whether it was when I was at Del Posto hiring line cooks or sous chefs, or now at Pig Beach or Pig Bleecker, one of the main things I look for in any sort of person applying is just, do they have a good attitude? Are they excited about what they want to do every single day? And, you know, outside of that, like, I can more or less teach people the rest, but I would prefer sometimes just to have a clean slate of somebody that's super excited and super eager that just wants to learn and see and do and, you know, go from there. I mean, one of the greatest examples of this is my chef, Stephen Fugate, who opened up Pig Beach and Pig Bleecker with me. He came in to Del Posto because he knew a friend that got him a stage. And he came in, his previous experience, he had no culinary training at all, but his previous experience was the Outback. And he worked at Outback Steakhouse for like 3 or 4 years. And kid knew how to grill a steak, so we like immediately put him on the roast station. We're like, all right, you know how to grill a steak, here you go, cook lamb chops and steaks all night long. But what he lacked in sort of formal training, he made up for it like tenfold with just his sort of personality and his attitude and his eagerness to like want to learn more and want to stay late and want to see everything and do everything. So that goes a long, long way in this industry.
So you heard it here first. If you work your ass off and you worked at Outback Steakhouse, you can end up working at a 4-star New York Times restaurant.
You can.
Just put in the effort and really show up every day.
That's right.
Let's talk about Boston a little bit before we go to the break. Can you talk a little briefly, if you can just sum up kind of what happened in Boston when you got out of culinary school? It was still on the come up a little bit. Boston was when you were there. It's now sort of solidifying itself as a culinary powerhouse. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily say that happened more than honestly 5 or 7, 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So when you were there, what was it like? Where were you working? And what did you kind of glean from that experience?
All right. So the quick version, I graduated culinary school in 2004. So part of the CIA requires you to do what they call an externship program. So I did mine in Boston at a restaurant called Pagel that was in the theater district for Chef Mark Orfali. Now, I was recommended to go to that restaurant because Jason Knoll had worked with him when he did his stage at Olive's restaurant with Todd English. So at the time, Mark Orfali was a sous chef for Todd English at Olive's. And at that time, like Barbara Lynch was a sous chef and you know, Tony Susi was there. So a lot of these big name juggernaut Boston chefs were working in that one kitchen under Todd, and it was sort of like that heyday of really incredible people. So I did my internship, graduated culinary school, and then Chef Orfali called me back. He's like, what are you doing? We'd love to have you come back to Boston. And, you know, my internship was really hard. It was, you know, 6 days a week, like 15 hours a day. My second day on the job, the kid that was working Garmage no called, no showed. So he put me on the station and said, all right, let's see what you got. Yeah, lucky me. Let's see what you got. And, you know, I survived. And he's like, all right, well, the station's yours now. I can fill that slot with a very, very inexpensive intern, and I don't have to hire somebody. So like, winner, winner, chicken dinner, let's go. The really cool thing about my experience and internship at Pagel was Jamie Bissonette was my sous chef there at the time. Jamie Bissonette is now like super chef, celebrity star, chef owner of Toro. And Little Donkey and a couple other restaurants with Ken Oringer, and also like an amazing human being of a guy. I love him. He's just the best. And he took me under his wing when I was at Pagel and showed me tons and tons of stuff. So anyways, I came back after graduating culinary school, valedictorian of my class, if you will. And a little side note in there, it's funny. Went back to work at Pagel, and then kind of like, I don't know, 6 months into being back at Pagel, I was like, you know, I now remember why this was like so hard. And, I didn't want to do it anymore. So Jamie Bissonette left Pagal, and he was opening up a restaurant called Eastern Standard, this gigantic restaurant near Fenway, and wanted me to come and work with him there as one of his sous chefs. So I, you know, being the open book that I am, being very upfront and honest, I went right back to Chef Rafale and said, hey, this is what the opportunity is that's happening. You know, it seems like really too good to turn down, but I always want to be upfront with you and let you know what's happening. And he said, Matt, you've always said that you wanted to go to Italy. You've always said you wanted to go and work in New York. He's like, what if I told you I can make both of those things happen? And I was like, whoa, all right, I'm listening. So Mark Rafale set me up with a stage to work with Mark Ladner at Lupa and Otto for about 2 weeks down in New York City. And I was able to stay on a friend's couch for those 2 weeks I was down there, which was great. And then they sent me to Italy, where I lived and worked for about 3 months with two different families. I basically lived above the restaurant with the Nona of one restaurant called Irriki, that was in Cercina, just outside of Tuscany, and another restaurant called Il Rosolino that was in Pienza for this amazing couple that ran the restaurant, two husband and wife couple. There was literally 12 seats in the restaurant. And in Italy, when you dine out, the seat's yours for the entire night. So like, they don't turn tables like we do here in the rest of the country. So I had that incredible opportunity, and then I came back and we opened up Mark Orfali's Italian-American, like Roman-influenced trattoria called Marco, after his name. And I was the opening chef de cuisine of that restaurant at 24, which was terrifying. But we did great. We got an incredible review from the Boston Herald, I think is the one that does the restaurant reviews, or the Globe, I forget which one. And tons of great accolades. I was nominated as like a new rising star chef through Star Chefs, and had a bunch of other great things that I've forgotten about because I'm old now, I guess. But that was what sort of catapulted me to just really continue to pursue my Italian pedigree and heritage. So I worked at Marco for 4 years until I kind of got to a point where I felt like I outgrew Boston a little bit and I wanted to immerse myself in deeper waters. And Mark Ladner would come back and forth to Boston from time to time because him and Mark Rafale were actually really good friends. They went to high school together and culinary school together. So I called up Ladner. He said, Maddie, come on down. We'd love to have you. And I was really excited because I want to go and work at Lupa, because I was never into like really super fine dining, really fancy food. But Ladner said, you know, I'm not at Lupa anymore. We just opened up this brand new restaurant called Del Posto. I would really love for you to come and work with me there. If you want to work at Lupa, we can totally make that happen, but I'd rather you be at Del Posto. So
we're going to take a quick break.
All
and
right.
Then we come back. We're going to talk Del Posto.
Del Posto years. Let's do it.
Stick with us here on the line with Chef Matt Abdu. We'll be right back after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com.
Welcome back to the line. My guest today is Chef Matt Abdu. He is taking us through his whirlwind life and tour of upstate New York, CIA, Boston, Italy. He's going all over the place, but now we're actually coming back in the second half of the show to New York. Right before the break, you dropped in Mark Ladner's name, who I was excited that you brought up because he's... sort of known as like the pasta king, right?
Indeed.
So for those that have never had the pleasure of going to Del Posto, it is a pretty gigantic, extremely upscale, sort of old school, classic New York restaurant, multiple levels, tasting menu. Mm-hmm. So you end up there with Mark Ladner. You're what, 26, 27 years old?
I was 27. Cool.
So
I got to Del Posto.
You're at kind of the, you're kind of like at the high end Mecca. You're in New York at what becomes a 4-star restaurant. What is
that? That was bananas.
What is that experience like in that kitchen with that amount of pressure, even with all the work you'd done up until then? How are you feeling at that point?
I mean, things are totally different when you're in your 20s and you're young and you're hungry and you're like, I don't, and you're single, you don't have a family, a girlfriend, kids or anything. You literally have zero responsibilities and you can channel every single ounce of your focus and your effort and your time and your talents into this one thing. It really opens up a lot of doors, and that's pretty much exactly what I did. I mean, I left Boston, my girlfriend at the time and I split up after being together for like 4 years, and you know, you're depressed about that, but yet you're super excited for this new opportunity that's happening in New York. And it was full speed ahead when we got down there. So I left Boston being the chef de cuisine of a really great restaurant, making a decent salary for what I made for, you know, back then, which still was barely enough to make rent in the life of a chef. But I left there to come to Del Posto. Spoke with Mark Ladner. He said, you know, everybody we go through goes through like a 3-month sort of training phase. So for those 3 months, we can only pay you $9 an hour. And I was like, ugh, that's
rough.
You know, my rent is like, I'm splitting a two-bedroom converted to a 3-bedroom. And my rent, my share of the rent was like $1,800. I was like, oh, I don't, okay.
All
right, we're gonna figure out a way to make this happen. So I got to work a lot of extra overtime for banquets. Thank God they had that. That's the only way I was able to make ends meet. But I worked, started off on Garmage, with the intention of being promoted to a sous chef. So, you know, I worked Garmage at that station back when we had what was called the Enoteca. It was sort of like a smaller restaurant with inside of Del Posto that was a lower price point, that was a separated area in the dining room. They stopped doing that, but it was a different menu. So you had the Enoteca menu and then the main dining menu. So Garmage was picking up both Enoteca menu stuff and main dining room menu stuff. So it got a little chaotic. There was typically 3 people that worked that station, 1 person that expedited and plated and made sure everything was good, and then 2 other little worker bees that kind of put together the rest of the plate. So, you know, I just got my butt kicked, and I worked Garmage for a lot of younger kids that were younger than me but had been at the restaurant for, you know, 6 months or a year or whatever. And, you know, I started showing my aptitude and my abilities and was quickly promoted to being a junior sous chef at the end of the month versus having to wait for the 3-month period. And then after a year, I was promoted to a senior sous chef. And then after 3 years, I was promoted to executive sous chef. And the funny thing was, is that I never wanted to stay. I always said that, you know, I want to be in New York for 2-3 years at the most. I just want to get whatever culinary talent and training I can get out of it. Because being from a small town in upstate New York, I was never thought that being in a big city of Manhattan or New York City would be for me. But every time that I was thinking about leaving, I kept getting promoted until finally I got promoted to be the chef de cuisine of the restaurant in 2012. I was promoted to chef de cuisine, and I held that title until I left in 2016, and I had an incredible journey and opportunity to work with, you know, side by side with Mark Ladner, who's like a big brother mentor to me, one of the greatest guys on the planet. If you guys don't know or didn't have a chance to eat at Del Posto when he was there, go to Pasta Flyer, because the pastas he's making there in a fast casual concept are just as good as all the incredible pastas he made at Del Posto. And they're like $6 to $8 a bowl or something ridiculously cheap. So go and check him out.
Very cool what he's doing. And actually, it's cool that both of you have actually... you both have moved away from the fine dining world, which we'll talk about in a second. But so, you know, you gain all this intense experience in the kitchen, but also there's a wonderful sort of financial aspect which you benefit from, which is that you connect with Rob, who is a Del Posto investor. So you actually were able to get interested in barbecue and then transition that into a business because of a mutual love and respect for barbecue that you had with a Del Posto investor.
Yep.
So often on the show, I ask like, well, where'd you get the money from to open up your project? But you were actually like, you were recipe testing, pop-up contesting with Rob. So you met Rob, and then what happened?
Well, you know what's really so all of this the story is just kind of crazy how it kind of goes off. So at our times at Del Posto, Mark Ladner and I were enthralled with the region of Abruzzo in Italy and the culture of the spiedinis that they do out there. So the reason I met Rob Schauger was because Mark and I took a trip to Austin, Texas to go and see how American barbecue could potentially correlate with the region of Abruzzo, Italian barbecue, and just to see if we could draw any sort of inspiration from it. So we went to Austin. Rob Schauger joined us on the trip. Jeff Porter, who's the wine director of like B&B hospitality for like the entire East Coast. He's like a super, super sommelier man and incredible human being. We love JPO. We went to Austin, Texas. We ate at Franklin's. We went to Louis Mueller's. We went to Black's. We went to City Market. I mean, we went to all the big name places in Austin and literally had the meat sweats. It was like insane what we did. But Rob and I bonded pretty quickly on the first night over our mutual love for food and beverages. And it was funny. At the end of the night, after going to like five or six barbecue joints and completely overdoing it, everybody else wanted to go out and get like tacos and tequila. And I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm staying home. And Rob's like, I can't breathe. I'm not leaving either. So I hung out with Rob, and Rob is notoriously a white wine drinker. And he kept like offering me drink some white wine with him and hang out. And the funny thing was, is being like stuffed to the gills and sweating meat, we were watching the Hunger Games. It was really kind of strange. But we bonded on that trip. And then when he left, he said, you know, anytime you want, I barbecue all the time on the weekends. Come and hang out at my home in Sag Harbor. We'll do up the barbecue. We'll like just have some fun. Love to have you out to my home. And I was like, okay, that's cool. I've never been to the Hamptons before. This is like swanky and fun. Let's do this.
Right.
So like the following week, he sent a car to pick up me, Mark Ladner, and Mark Ladner's girlfriend, Nastasia. And we went out to his home in Sag Harbor. And he had this Tucker, you know, drum style smoker. And we cooked like 12 racks of ribs and two pork shoulders and a bunch of sausages. And I was like, this is so cool. This is awesome. And we ended up, he's like, anytime you want, come on out. So we ended up becoming buddies, and he would invite me out there, and I'd take the train out or the jitney out, and we'd barbecue over the weekend. And again, I'm single at the time. I don't have any commitments. So I'm working at Del Posto, and my weekends I'm going and hanging out with Rob at his house. And we started getting really good at it to the point where he started entering us into local barbecue competitions in Long Island and Staten Island, and we started winning those. And then he's like, all right, well, I'm going to get us into Memphis in May. Let's see what we can do there. So
That's the big show.
It's one of the big ones. So like of all the biggest barbecue competitions in our country, there's the Royal, the Jack, and Memphis in May. So those three are like the top three. And I think they call the Memphis in May the World Series of Barbecue is what they nickname it. But, you know, you have all the biggest and the best barbecue guys in the country competing there. So my first year down there, we won second place in whole hog and first place in poultry. And like everyone's heads were exploding. We're like, what just happened? The people down there, the Southerners and the Midwesterners were like, who are these New Yorkers up on stage? What is Salty Rinse Barbecue?
You don't even have a restaurant at that point, right?
Well, I'm still working at Del Posto.
Right, but you don't have a barbecue restaurant.
No, I certainly don't have a barbecue restaurant.
You're like a Salty, team of mercenaries or something like that.
Salty Rinse Barbecue. Salty Rinse is the name of Rob's wine that he has made for him. So like he's like, oh, Salty Rinse Barbecue. And you know,
sure,
like,
why not?
Why not? Exactly, right? So they're like, who are these guys? So anyways, we took that victory. Second place in whole hog for us was a huge victory. We took that victory to launch Pig Beach as a pop-up in Gowanus. And at the time, when we took over the space, it was partnered with another company called Swan Dive. So Swan Dive controlled all the booze. Pig Beach only did the food. Now, anybody that owns a restaurant knows that in order for a restaurant to succeed financially, you need to have a beverage program. So it was truly just a pop-up just for us to get to see if we could produce barbecue on a consistent level.
Mm-hmm.
We hired in a couple of guys to run it. Again, I'm still full-time at Del Posto, so I can't even really be at the pop-up all that much. I come after work, and I come on my weekends. But we certainly had some struggles doing it, you know, working outside in the rain and the cold, and we had literally a tent and a mobile rig smoker. It was kind of bananas. But, you know, by the end of the summer, we finally kind of got our stuff together and started doing and producing pretty consistently good barbecue. And our landlords asked us if we wanted to take over the entirety of the space. And we were like, well, here's our opportunity. But the funny part was, is when Rob took me to the abandoned lot that is now Pig Beach, it was kind of scary. It's Gowanus. I don't know what Gowanus is. I'm living in Hell's Kitchen at the time. I like never come to Brooklyn. It's like it might as well be a different country out here.
Yeah, it was like a total gravel parking lot type of vibe, right? Oh, it was terrifying.
Yeah, completely. A gravel parking lot, cars on cinder blocks.
Yeah.
You know, rolled up barbed wire. I mean, it was kind of a lot like what Roberta's backyard was prior to them expanding and taking it over. It was very, very similar, which is really kind of cool. But Rob had the vision, as well as the rest of the team, of what we could do and how we could bring, you know, that fun concept to the area. And in the last 3.5 years, we've really evolved that space to be now a paved backyard lot, which was once a seasonal restaurant operation, is now a full year-round business. We built out 10,000 square feet of additional indoor space last fall, which has been really successful and really great. So now we're indoor, outdoor, 23,000 square feet in total barbecue beer garden operation. It's pretty epic.
And you've got picnic tables, you've got cornhole, there's a whole, like you said, inside space, which is obviously very nice on either super hot days or when it's maybe raining. But in its first kind of incarnation as a pop-up, when you're still at Del Posto, are you thinking to yourself, wow, this is really going to end up being a thing? Or were you thinking, I don't know, where was your thought process at? Did you think that Pig Beach was the next stage in your career? Or did you think that was a fun side project and you were going to stay fine dining?
No, that's a great question. I knew that fine dining for me had an expiration date. Like, even in my time, Ladner and I would kid about how we would want to do these new projects that definitely weren't fine dining. I mean, fine dining takes its toll on you as a cook. I mean, you have to have a very specific mindset to have that be the continuing rest of your career and culture, because it's very stressful. It's a very pressure cooker environment to make sure that, you know, within cooking, you have a window of acceptability. When you're working at a restaurant like Del Posto, that window of acceptability is very, very small, meaning that the precision has to be almost perfect on every single plate. And to have that stress level of like perfection every single time is very daunting and very stressful. But, you know, I kind of got to the point in my career. So I'm 10 years into Del Posto, I'm now, you know, 35 years old, 36 years old, and I'm thinking to myself, I want to be a partner. I don't want to continue to be an employee. So kind of what really was the extension for me to pursue Pig Beach full-time and leave Del Posto was, A, I kind of got to my ceiling there. I knew I wasn't going any higher. But an incredible journey of having amazing opportunities, working side by side with Mark Ladner and Mario Batali, and getting to like meet my, you know, idols and mentors, and just having an incredible experience. I got to a point where I sat down with Mario and said, "Chef, look, I'm at a point now where I want to be a partner in my next project." And he, you know, more or less said that opportunity wasn't available to be a partner. That's just not what they do. And I said, "Well, I totally understand. No hard feelings, but I think it's time for me to pursue something new." And, you know, Rob was really pressuring and pushing me to pursue this Pig Beach concept. So that's kind of what the catalyst was for me to leave Del Posto and pursue Pig Beach full time.
So at this point now, today, there's Pig Beach in Gowanus. There's also a Pig Bleecker in the city.
Yep.
For those that are listening that aren't super familiar with the geography, those are not that close together. You've got restaurants, and they aren't just like a hop and a skip walk across the street to check on each other. One's absolutely gigantic. The other one's also pretty big. Barbecue is very difficult, right? You're cooking over wood. It's long cook periods. How do you manage both restaurants? How do you maintain the quality and the precision that you know you can, since you have this long cooking pedigree, when you got two restaurants that are far apart and doing a very old school complex cooking process?
Another great question. So the only thing I can really say is that we've been really blessed with being able to hire amazing talent to help us grow the company. You know, not to get on too much of a sad note, but my wife's twin brother, Jeff Michener, was the executive sous chef at Cereal Restaurant, and he left Cereal to come and open up Pig Beach with us when it was the pop-up. Jeff ran it when it was the pop-up. And then he went to work at Schiller's Liquor Bar when Pig Beach closed down for the season, and then came back to reopen up Pig Beach. And Jeff did an amazing job to help the restaurant grow to where it's become today. And it was really his baby, you know, and my, you know, just sort of oversight and help and like bringing him up to speed on certain things and showing him all the stuff that I had learned working with Rob. But sadly, Jeff passed away suddenly in May. He had a stroke or aneurysm or something had happened to him. So that was a huge blow to us. I mean, my life and world was completely turned upside down by that. And you know, being so intertwined within my wife's twin brother, my very dear friend, my executive chef and partner at Pig Beach, was now gone. And it was very challenging for me to figure out how to pick up those pieces and be in both places at once. And it was very difficult. But I was able to, you know, lean on some other staff that I had, promote some other guys, and sort of rally around, because everybody loved Jeff and everybody didn't want what his legacy that he helped build there to fade away. So everyone really rallied behind that to really help. And plus, too, we've had great guys and retention in the back of house at both restaurants, where the great thing about barbecue is, as challenging as it can be, because you're basically just trying to keep a consistent heat and a consistent fire so that things don't die out or things don't spike. But once you get guys trained up on it, and we have an incredible team of guys that have been trained really, really well and know exactly what to do, that if I come in there and I say I want a taste of everything, they cut it up, and 9 times out of 10, everything is just lights out great. You know, every now and again, there'll be a little hiccup of, they, you know, didn't put enough smoke on this, or maybe they didn't season that enough, or maybe like the bark wasn't developed as good as it should be on the brisket. But for the most part, I mean, we have a great team that does a really, really great job. And, you know, I one of the biggest things that I think is important for as a chef, operator, and a restaurateur is you have to create a culture and an environment for your employees that makes them want to be a part of your growth and make them want to be excited about what it is that you're doing, so that they can feel that they have a career ahead of them to be something that's more than just a job. And it's always been very important to me to make people feel comfortable where they work and make them feel excited about what they're working, give them opportunities to play with different things and run specials. And when you give people that sort of freedom and opportunity for advancement and creativity, it sort of creates an environment where people just really want to do a great job, because then they feel really attached to the program, that it's theirs and they can own it. And that's been really helpful to be able to manage my ability to go back and forth between the restaurants to have it happen that way.
You obviously just touched on an incident with your family that could have become insurmountable. That seems like more difficult than almost any issue that any restaurateur could ever face, because it's multi-layered and multifaceted. I'm curious, besides that, which obviously majorly impacted your life as a restaurant owner, just the day to day in New York, what scares you and concerns you the most about being a restaurant owner? Maybe besides, you know, a staffing major issue, or, you know, something in your life, like what, as a business owner, what really maybe keeps you up at night?
You know, it's funny. We joke about it, and, you know, on there's certain days we'll just say, why would anybody ever want to own a restaurant? Because it's probably one of the most insane and grueling and crazy things that has so many different moving pieces that most people that dine out regularly that don't work in the restaurant industry have no idea about. Between health department inspections, keeping things clean, having the staff be on time, having the staff show up sober, you know, having enough business to pay the bills, to pay the rent, to pay the payroll, the overheads, the electric bill. I mean, there's so many expenses, and it's in an industry that is so overly critiqued. Like, there's very few industries out there where if you go, people have an open platform to express their frustrations and their happiness. But most of the time, the only things that get posted are the unhappy thoughts that you hear. And that in itself can be a very depressing and frustrating and difficult thing to deal with as a restaurant owner, because we get into this as chefs. I got into this for chefs. You know, if people have been listening since the beginning of this program, food for me was always about love and about being able to make people happy and bring people together. So when people dine at any of my restaurants, the one thing I want to do is embrace them with the warm hug of what food was for me when I was a kid, when my mother and my grandmothers would be cooking for me. All we want to do is make you happy. So it's important that if you're unhappy or we haven't met your expectations or something isn't right, please let us know then and there so we can have the opportunity to fix it and correct it and make you happy. Because I promise you, that's all we're trying to do, is to create an experience that makes you happy and leaves you wanting to come back again and again. So when you don't do that and we don't have an opportunity to fix it and we don't know, and then the things go up into the ether, and then it's like, oh my God, what happened? Why did this happen? Why did this happen? Obviously, if you don't have guests coming to your restaurant, you don't have an influx of money to pay your staff and pay your bills and pay your employees and everything else that goes with it. So I think one of the biggest things that keeps you up as a restaurateur and owner at the end of the night is, you know, how can I continuously stay relevant? How can I continuously stay in the public's eye of being a really awesome, fun place that people want to eat at. Because the second you become complacent and the second you like sit on your laurels and think you're good and you've made it, is the second that somebody else is going to come up and do it better than you, and then you could fall to the wayside, and then you start seeing your sales drop, and then things just kind of start, you know, just going away, and it can be a very scary thing. So you always have to be on your toes. You always have to be pushing. You always have to be trying to stay relevant, do new things, do new dishes, new items, new events, do this promotion, do that promotion, and just really always push and work as hard as you can to like make sure that you're not falling to the wayside.
It used to be just you had to cook good food and hopefully people came, but now it's really a data business. Right?
You have to be on Instagram. You have to be on Facebook.
You have to know the numbers. You can't just show up and put out plates and say, oh, we did 100 covers tonight. That must have been good. Like, you have to really drill down into the data.
Oh, 100 covers, that must have been good. But wait, our check average our check average should be $50 a person, and it's only $30 a person. Why is that? Well, the majority of people now are ordering the hamburger because you've gotten so much press and praise on your hamburger within Burger Bash and everything else, and Eater and Thrillist and Gotham Burger Social Club. Everyone's coming for your burger, but your burger is one of the lowest price averages on the menu.
You need him to order those ribs and those brisket.
That's a crazy thing. It's like you would never think that praise and good publicity would be something that could be detrimental to a restaurant. Totally. But like, if you have dishes on the menu that you're hoping people eat more of, and they're ordering the lower price point menu item because that's what's gotten all the recognition, it's just a whirlwind, man.
The sort of the name of the business that everyone's kind of moving towards now is, I have a concept. It has the ability to be replicated, expanded.
Yep.
It's not really the Nana 20-seat, 13-seat restaurant anymore. Yeah. It's now, hey, good concept. I really liked your meal. How many can you open and how quickly can you open them?
Yeah.
That being said, Pig Beach, Pig Bleecker, do you think either of them have the ability to be replicable, and do you have interest in doing so outside of the New York area?
Oh, I love that question. Pig Bleecker is not really so much as replicable as Pig Beach model is. Pig Bleecker is still a very, you know, chef-driven, sit-down restaurant. There's a menu, there's service, there's a wine list, there's cocktails, there's the whole gambit of things that go along with it, and it really needs the direct attention of myself or, you know, somebody that I could hire to be like the chef de cuisine or the executive chef of the restaurant to really run it. But the reality is that restaurants like Pig Bleecker and many small restaurants in the city, you know, they struggle to break even every week and every month because it's, you know, with what rents are in the city, it's outrageous, and what labor is in the city is outrageous, and it's very difficult. So Pig Bleecker replicable, is it? Sure, but probably we wouldn't do it only because from a financial point of view, it wouldn't really make sense. Pig Beach, however, there's a lot of things in the works right now of getting to expand that brand. I mean, it's fun, it's kitschy, it's cute, it's clever. The food's incredible. We have it locked into a point now where we can really replicate it on mass scale as well. And there's also talks and abilities of either expanding the Pig Beach brand itself or doing spin-offs of it, of like Pig Beach Piglets. That could be a potential fast casual concept of like, get your Pig Beach burger and your ribs and your pulled pork sandwich or your brisket sandwich kind of thing as well. So that's certainly a more replicable model that we're actively pursuing.
I'm going to get you out of here on this last question. You, over the course of your career, you've had the ability to work with a lot of incredible chefs, Mark mm-hmm. Ladner, Jamie Bissonette, the brothers at Cafe Canole, lots and lots of people inspired you. You said you lean on a lot of them for mentorship. Now you're at the top of the food pyramid and young cooks are coming to you and they're asking
I'm
you
flattered by that.
For
Thank
your,
you.
Your advice. What do you say to a young cook who's having a bad day and going down in flames? And also, what do you say to someone who says, I want to open up my own spot one day? Mm-hmm. Are those different sentiments that you're giving them? Like, what do you say to inspire someone now that you've been able to open your own places and people are looking to you and saying, oh, I kind of want to do what Matt's doing.
Yeah. Well, I wish this radio show was an extra hour long because we can continue to talk about this stuff at length. But when I was on the line at Del Posto and I was getting beat up and I was having a hard night, and regardless of how good I thought I was, you know, there are nights where things are going to go wrong and people are going to send food back. And the thing I would say to myself over and over is that this will pass. This will pass. And you have to have a short-term memory. Like, in the restaurant biz, you can have a great night and be like super stoked about it, but like the next night you can go down in a pile of flames. You just have to be like, Every day is a clean slate. Every day is new. Come to work with a great attitude. Learn from your mistakes. It's just the biggest thing. That's what I would tell cooks, is that learn from your mistakes. Tomorrow's a new day. You have a complete opportunity to show what you're capable of doing. But you have to come back to work with a positive attitude every single day with a clean slate, ready to rock. That would be my biggest advice that I would give to anybody that's having a hard or stressful day in the restaurant biz. As far as opening up your own place, my advice to anybody that talks to me about this is, do you love what you do? And if the answer is yes, do you want people to have an opportunity to have what you have every single day? And they say yes. I said, all right. So then the next step is you have to start thinking like a business plan and a business model. You have to get numbers together. And do you know like what you're anticipating, how many seats, what your check average is and all this stuff? And when they say, oh my God, I've never thought about that stuff. And I said, well, why don't we get a coffee? I can run you through how these things sort of work, because you just can't say, oh, I love food, I love cooking, poof, I'm going to open up a restaurant. There is so much stuff that goes into it before you can even begin to like express what you want to do to potential investors to like get you the money to do what you want to do. I mean, I lucked out. I had my buddy and dear friend, Rob Schauger, who had access to being able to raise money for us to open up these restaurants. But most people don't. Most people have the ability to be an incredible cook, but just not the means of getting the financing together to actually open up their dream place. And it's a lot of work and takes a lot of time and a lot of knowledge that, you know, you have to really, really well research before you go forth and try to do it.
Matt, let everybody who's listening know where they can find both of your spots.
Please. Pig Beach Barbecue is on 480 Union Street in Gowanus between Bond Street and what we like to call the Brooklyn Riviera of the Gowanus Canal. It doesn't smell anymore. It's wonderful. And even if it did, the beautiful aroma of our barbecue masks it all anyway. So come see us over there in Brooklyn. And we have Pig Bleecker that's located on 155 Bleecker Street, the corner of Bleecker and Thompson, where you can come and get delicious sit-down American comfort food with great grilled items and burgers, ribs, brisket. Oh my, come and see us. And we're also doing an incredible Halloween party at Pig Beach for both children and adults, and incredible catering for the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas. Get your whole turkeys, your green bean casserole, mashed potatoes. Pre-order it starting November 1st at both Pig Bleecker and Pig Beach. We'd love to see you.
Matt, thanks so much for being here and sharing your story with everyone listening and with The Line.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Everybody, tune in every Tuesday at 11 a.m. And a quick shout out to next week's episode. I've got Brandon Hoy from Roberta's coming in to talk about the whole chaotic madness of the place that we're sitting right now where we record our show. So join us next week and every Tuesday at 11 a.m. for more episodes of The Line here on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.